My name's Steve Draper. I give this module along with Lorna Morrow, although the timetable would have suggested that Lorna would begin. She's ill for the moment, so you're going to get my part of the course first. Actually, let me just check something else. So there should be some single honours level 3 psychology students here. Yes? There should be some psychological studies from level 3. Yes? And there should be some people from the MSc conversion course. Yes? Good. Okie dokie. Right. So, two of us give this course. In the handbook, there's quite detailed spec, but you now have to swap the two halves of the course around. I've given them in the other order because Lorna says she's ill. The course as a whole covers both the history of psychology and conceptual issues. There's a couple of textbooks there. Let me just say, and I'll put this up again afterwards, if I go back to the first slide, a quick way to find material on this course is to go to this webpage of mine. I'll be putting up the slides there, and there'll be either audio recordings or at least pointers to them there, reading list, various other things. Probably if you Googled Draper chip, you'd get there more or less in one go. Unless I've got an unknown relative in the timber business. Right. Now, first of all, you should have the statutory health warning. Who the hell am I? Well, one reason I'm teaching part of this course is my own undergraduate degree, which was in fact in physics. I've had a long and confused life. So nice to meet young people with a single clear idea. But one thing that made a deep impression on me, I mean, I adored physics, but one thing that made a deep impression on me is we had to do in first year a philosophy of science or philosophy of physics course, and that gave me a different perspective that I maintained throughout that program. Made me think about physics in a less uncritical and admiring way. It didn't stop me enjoying every moment of it, but it made me think a lot about the ways in which physics exceeded its promises and the ways in which it hadn't even begun to fulfill some of the things that an outsider might very reasonably expect it to. Now, that's not uncommon, but the trouble is if you're simply immersed in a specialist field, like most undergraduates are, most of the lecturers, besides worshipping their field and not having the faintest clue about anything else, naturally are full of all the things they know and you don't and want to unload them. But it's also good to spend a certain amount of time trying to develop an outsider view about just what is good and bad in the field, what ought it to be doing but no one's found a way to do it yet, and so on and so forth. So particularly this first part of the course is all about trying to foster in you a way of thinking about the field from outside. Now, at least for single honours students, you'll already be realising that you're required to exhibit critical thinking skills. Actually, everyone should do that, but we particularly bully our single honours psychology students in level 3 to develop that ability. Another way of thinking about this, then, is it's a special form of critical thinking which I hope to foster and inculcate in you. So that's my ambition. If it works on a few of you, that's good. So Lorna's material talks about the facts, about the history of people, about particular concepts on movements like behaviorism or psychoanalysis. But my aim is to ask whether it should have been like that. Did it have to be like that? How can we understand psychology from outside it? And it's always good when researchers get too cocky to have some arguments ready about whether we should believe a word they say. Now I'm going to say something slightly at a level removed here, which is both motivation for this learning aim of mine to develop critical thinking, but it's also a comment on how I think you should work in relation to this course. First of all, why does critical thinking matter? Well, there's some recent arguments from the education literature that if you look at the list of graduate attributes, the kind of general intellectual qualities that universities would like their graduates to go away with, that you can in fact regard evaluative judgment as the underpinning for all of that, the ability to make judgments, to distinguish good and bad, certain from less certain, from absolute nonsense. Secondly, why does discussion by students matter? Well, because it's entirely possible, and this is based on data collected by a research student of mine last year, a level 4 maxi student, that discussion may, rather than being lectured at or reading a book, actually actively participating in discussion may be the chief way of improving your abilities at evaluative judgment and at critical thinking. Now, the anecdote. I'm old enough now that even my youngest sister has put her kids through university now. And having dinner with her and my brother-in-law a year or two ago, I asked them whether they felt it had been worthwhile sending them to university, since there I was, a university lecturer talking to a farmer who's not necessarily sympathetic to the idea of education at all. And they paused a moment and then came back with what in a sense is the perfect answer, even though it wouldn't be in their nature to try and please me, really. They said, well, they certainly came back and argued with us in an entirely different way. So, no change of the hormones, but a change in the ways of annoying their parents in deeper ways. And I think that's as it should be. I think that's actually something like what it is that you hopefully pick up at university that will turn out to be something you actually use generally afterwards. Second part is, in the last few years, a research interest of mine has been whether, because I found this 400-year-old essay, which seems to me still important and true today, which suggested there are really three things that learning is based on. And I think in that context, learning refers to the kind of study you do in universities. And these essays argue that you have to do reading, you have to do writing, and you have to do discussion, and that it's no good trying to just do one or two of those and hope doing more of the rest will compensate. You actually need all three because they give you different things. So that made me start worrying about whether in this department, in this school, in psychology, we do nearly enough to make sure students discuss. And I don't know whether I should be worried or not, because in informal pilot work to dignify casual chatting with students, one of them came up and said, oh no, she doesn't discuss anything with students, no. But on the other hand, she mentioned, it was quite often the night before she had to do an essay would phone up her mum and give her mum 2 or 3 hours earful of the essay. And that would suggest that that even if you don't have a very willing audience, it's still somehow a necessary part, and maybe it happens without interference. But on the other hand, maybe it does matter. So this is my research student, and what he wasn't really looking for exactly this result, but what his dependent variable was an American test of critical thinking. And it turned out that the significant results showed that how well people did on the test was considerably influenced by who they lived with. Worst off were students who either lived alone or lived in a flat with people they weren't really friends with. Next best was people who lived with their parents. And although not everyone's parents are argumentative, university-educated people, they're quite likely to be. But the people who did best were people who lived with their peers, who lived with other students, not necessarily in their own subject. So I think maybe it's natural to people in general, but certainly people learning, to want to discuss things. But we don't seem, on the whole, to make that a priority. I bet none of you have blocked out in your timetable a couple of hours each week where you're going to find someone to discuss intellectual matters. Almost none of us timetable it, but that doesn't mean that it isn't important. So if someone has a natural urge but hasn't got a conscious goal for doing it, it's going to depend on the opportunities that arise, whether it's a phone call to mum or arguing with your flatmates. And it would seem, therefore, that who you live with may affect how well much you develop critical thinking, and that's probably because it changes the opportunities for discussion. So I'm going to try for the first time this year setting a discussion question after each lecture. I've got the first pair up on the web page I showed you, and I'll try and keep up doing that with each lecture. Now, onwards. So, I'm going to try and equip you with a higher level of critical thinking, the various types of critical thinking. So number one, the kind of thing the level threes are going to be getting any minute now in their tutorial groups, is taking a paper that describes a single experiment and critiquing mostly the method and the stats used in that experiment. A bit higher than that, sort of question that tends to interest me more in critiquing psychology research is, whether the question the experiment or hypothesis that the experiment was designed to address was in fact the right one. Because one of the weaknesses of the experimental method is it tests whether your guess was right. But if you actually have a clue and aren't guessing anything interesting or important, then it's much less likely that the experiment will help. So, for instance, I've worked for decades in the university. Only recently have I stumbled across the idea that maybe reading, discussion, and writing should be thought of as an essential triad, and should I be worried as a course designer that I'm not making enough opportunity for discussion. And of course, because I didn't used to think about that, then I didn't get persuade students to do research on whether discussion is useful and how and to whom. So, number two, critiquing whether even the right hypothesis is being tested is another one. But what I'm going to be talking about in the first seven lectures is this third one about, can we come to any sort of outside opinion about whether psychology is doing well? Questions like, well, what would someone who doesn't particularly care about psychology expect it to do? Is it even a sensible topic? After all, at the moment in Western culture, we certainly think some things aren't worth studying. Astrology, the shape of your fingernails is a predictor of who you're going to marry. There are lots of things we'd regard as too mad to discuss. Of course, it might turn out we're wrong. But the point is, there are plenty of things we don't think are worth studying, but others that we do. And just because a question occurs doesn't mean, and just because some researcher begins work in a field doesn't actually mean it's automatically a sensible field. Third question would be, there's some well-developed sciences that have been around longer than psychology. How do psychology's methods compare to the other sciences? Is that an unfair question? Are we stealing methods that would help? Or are we wrongly ignoring methods that would help? Or do we have to develop new ones? Things like that. Now, I'm going to be mentioning some ideas from the philosophy of science, and most philosophy of science, especially in the past, has really been philosophy of physics, because physics was the longest established science. But in fact, different disciplines are different not just on the surface, not just in accidents of what they're studying, they're different in deeper ways. So there is a real question about whether a philosophy of science that gives insights into physics, will that or won't that give insights into psychology? That's a fair criticism, a question to keep in mind. Right, I think I'm going to begin with the issue of what types of explanation, what kinds of data does psychology use? And this is partly because this has been, as you perhaps already know, controversial even in the last 100 years, even during the not very long history of psychology, there have been violent differences of opinion. I'll begin, however, with some ideas not much used now about what might constitute data. So if you don't think of yourself as a psychologist, you're simply an ordinary person trying to understand others, which we have to do because we live in a social world. We have to deal with others, like it or not. What do we, as it were, come equipped with as children or as naive adults as ways of doing that? Well, we've probably got a few kind of inbuilt tendencies, all of which we can apply. So the first one is the tendency to see other entities as having intentions. So with people, it's certainly true. They do have goals, and if you can figure out what they want, that's a huge help in understanding their behaviour and how to deal with them. We also apply that to animals. If you wake up one morning, wander into the dining room, this is a middle class home, not a student dig, and there's a goldfish bowl, and there's a cat with its paw just over the goldfish bowl. And all of a sudden you have this tremendous conviction that you can do telepathy, and what's more, you can read the mind of other species. In other words, we get quite a long way with animals as well, thinking about what their goals are and the extent to which that explains their behaviour. A completely different mental... We tend to apply that schema even when we know that's not rational. So when you get annoyed with a computer, you probably start swearing at it more or less as if this was some disreputable tramp in the street. Why the hell did you destroy my data? And maybe you're too young for this, but the famous sketch from Fawlty Towers where John Cleese starts beating a car with a trunk of a tree. It's funny, but we all know how he feels. We're going to treat this car as a person who deserves punishment. Of course that's illogical, but what is that? That's treating other things as an intentional being, and we will have a go at that, not always reasonably. Now, the opposite of that is treating the other thing as an object, like a stone. And just to show that, in fact, it's not simple, that there's not an automatic rule for which schema you should apply to which kind of thing, is if you're being operated on by a surgeon, you want that surgeon to treat you as an object. You don't want the surgeon to come over all soft and wince and say, "Can't bear to cut you with a scalpel," and it slows him up and makes him clumsy, and he either can't bear to do it or it takes much longer. You would actually like him to be entirely cold-blooded and regard you as a lifeless piece of meat, because he'll do his job much better. So we have both those schemas, but to some extent we can apply either of them to anything, and that's sometimes functionally useful. Now, the third thing, Have you had lectures on theory of mind already? Does that ring a bell? Does that ring a bell on most people? It's a jargon word for the way that people and animals, some animals, can keep track of other living organisms, what they know. So the experiments that show this are typically about one actor, say me, reasons about whether another actor saw something and therefore knows it, or didn't see it and therefore doesn't know it. So that means not simply having a mind like a simple-minded filing cabinet where everything I know is in there, but there's no records of who knows what. Theory of Mind is beginning to deal with the idea that not only is there the stuff I know, but there's also stuff that other people know and don't know, and that can be useful. And as you may know, some animals show that very well. In fact, a few years ago I had a student whose other life was as a zookeeper at Edinburgh Zoo. She did her project on theory of mind in crows, some of the more intelligent birds around, and they keep track. So the issue for crows is a pecking order. If they like to bury food, but if they bury food and a more senior bird sees it, the senior bird will just go and eat it. So it's important for them to understand that, not to bury it if a bully is around, but it's entirely fine to bury it if your subordinates are around, because they won't dare. And interestingly, the birds in that context not only do that to other crows, they'll do that to humans. They remember which humans will take food away from them and which never do, and they will take care not to bury food in front of humans who interfere with them, but they don't mind who sees it if they're a softie. So that's theory of mind. Now, humans actually go a bit further than that. So one way of talking about what's different about humans than most animals is humans bear grudges. That, of course, is a negative spin, but the point is that the fact that even young children start saying it's not fair, the fact that we remember who's been bad and wish punishment on them and sometimes carry it out, but we also have notions of forgiveness and so on, is all about keeping track of an interpersonal, not just static properties of the other person, but a history, which is clearly a more complicated form of theory of mind. So we come pre-equipped with those. So that could be a possible start, but actually maybe it's not the one that, on the whole, psychologists focused on as a fundamental method. Another angle, if you're trying to build up a picture of where psychology fits from outside, is to look at its neighbouring disciplines. This isn't an exhaustive list, but if you start asking yourself what's the difference between sociology and social psychology, that's one interesting way to be thinking about one of the borders of psychology. A different one, anthropology, is about studying other cultures, and particularly it exposes how poor people who aren't trained anthropologists are, how poor we are at looking at a strange culture and having any idea about how to interpret it in the way that the people who live it do. Almost always we can't stop ourselves applying the frameworks from our culture as if they somehow ought to apply everywhere. Another border you probably nowadays have come across would be evolution theory from biology. Some psychologists attempt to think about whether we can gain useful insights by thinking about evolution and how that impacts human behavior. Another, interestingly, is economics. Someone who's got a publication record in psychology, Danny Kahneman, also got the Nobel Prize in Physics in economics for developing a theory, which is a rather good match to human behaviour, of how, of biases, I suppose is the way psychologists would think about it, about the biases in the decisions humans make for economic decisions. So if you look up Danny Kahneman on the web, you'll find a Wikipedia page and leads to what he got the prize for in his major papers. I think he calls it prospect theory, but it's about asymmetry, about how people who've made a bad investment still can't bear to sell it at less than what they paid for it, even though it's even when it's rational that they should do so. And one of the reasons that's interesting is because economics is quite a well-developed discipline, but it is a particular sub-area of human behaviour, how we behave economically. And the difficulty is that it's much easier for economics to reason about what would be rational behaviour of people in a market, but people aren't entirely rational in a market. Indeed, it may be worse than that. So on the one hand, there's Danny Kahneman and things about heuristic decision making, which has certain peculiar biases in which distort, from a rational point of view, distort economic behaviour. But it's even more than that. If you read the business section of newspapers and then find articles commenting in one way or another on crashes and so on, why the big stock market crashes, what causes them? Well, quite a good approximation is it's when most of the people in a market, including the traders, are no longer can remember, are no longer old enough to have lived through the previous crash. In spite of the fact they're all literate and that people write these books, there's something about the emotional experience of a crash which doesn't get passed on to the next generation. And so after 50, 60 years or so, people are more and more mindlessly optimistic. They believe that this time it's different. And then you get the next huge crash. Physiology, neurology, other kinds of neighbour. Each bringing their own techniques which can be useful. Each, though, posing a danger to psychology in that they'll have a tendency to think that it's all about the underlying physiology. So, those would be two ways, but the kinds of data I think I'm going to suggest to you a fundamental in psychology as it's practiced up to now goes like this. And I think I'm going to introduce it by the idea of trying to think about what would a reasonable question for a discipline be before anyone had done anything. So for physics, which I like so much, it clearly believes it and has from an early time, believes that part of its business is matters of water and evaporation and air pressure and so on. Well, weather is still important to me. I'd like to know whether I need to carry a waterproof coat with me when I come into work. And this must have been even more important if and when we lived in caves or as hunter-gatherers. Weather's almost always fundamentally important to humans, and it still is. And you'd certainly think that that was the most basic question physics ought to answer. And essentially, the main theoretical advance in the last 50 years in that area of physics has been chaos theory, which is an explanation of why we'll never be able to predict the weather. It might be physics business, but it's failed, and it's going to stay failed. Of course, physics has done many impressive things, just not what a layman might very reasonably demand. I mean, physics can tell you in quite astonishing detail about what goes on in the middle of the sun. Now, not only has no one been to the middle of the sun, we can't even imagine, let alone build a machine that would take us there. It is extraordinary to be able to reason with good evidence about processes so inaccessible. But, of course, that's not altogether what we want to know. It's just what it turns out can be known, at least in the present state. So that's the kind of thing it's a kind of way, one kind of way in which you might build a critique from outside of a discipline. What is it reasonable for people to want of a discipline, and has the discipline actually measuring up? So for psychology, I guess, and you'll know this because of the way your friends all react when you say you're doing psychology, half of them will immediately say, can you read my mind? So clearly we, outsiders expect psychologists to be able to read people's minds, but you've discovered that academic psychology makes no such promise. So it's that kind of failure against expectations to consider. Right, so what kinds of data or observation do we deal with? Well, I think really the three main kinds are behaviour, introspection and physiology. So behaviour, you can observe what people do rather than listening to their stories about why they do it. You can actually look at what they do. That's clearly one source of data. And we all know from daily experience that what people say and what they do aren't always consistent. By introspection, I'm using a negative spin word for all the self-report stuff, which is actually big business in psychology still. That is recording what people say about what they're thinking, feeling, or perceiving. And the third is physiology. It doesn't depend, you know, things like pulse rate and so on. Now, I think from an outside view, we would like a well researched area in psychology to be able to connect those. If it only managed to report behaviour and didn't connect to what the people were feeling when they behaved like that, and it didn't connect to physiology, we'd feel that was disappointing. We'd be most convinced when an area is mature enough, an area within psychology is mature enough to be able to connect those things. Now, just because that's what we'd like, of course, doesn't mean that's what's possible, but and that's why I've got it on a slide along with, well, what would a layman, what would an outsider expect of psychology? And I think an outsider above all would expect mature theorists of psychology to be able to connect these three kinds of behaviour. Even though individual studies are more often than not only dealing with one type of data, if it can't connect them, it somehow feels disappointing to us. Now there's two more which should be labelled E and F rather than A and B again. These are used quite a bit, but perhaps they're not as prominent as the main three. When I say functional, there's a lot of reasoning, and I think it's a useful line of reasoning in general. When you see people do something, you wonder, it might look unreasonable to me as an observer, but is it really serving a purpose that I haven't understood yet? So when a child goes through a fussy phase, says yuck to most of the food that the mother produces, and so on, are they just being difficult and should get a clip round the ear, or can we understand it in some other way? And it is, of course, highly likely that we all, in one way or another, have discussed reactions about food and so on, and those are almost certainly important before you have a public health officer endlessly lecturing on you on what you should eat. It's actually important not to just put any old thing in your mouth, because you won't live all that long if you do that. So that's just one little example, but always that's one kind of reasoning which is often thought about, is could this be a function? So another interesting question, for instance, personality traits, the big five or whatever they call it nowadays, is a rather mature area of psychology. It suggests that people vary across these five independent dimensions of personality. Well, a naive evolution theorist would say, surely there's the right kind of personality to have, better than all the others. And surely those of you with the wrong personality should be being edged out of the population, shouldn't you? So in other words, when you find permanently maintain diversity, then the question is, what's the the suspicion is there must be a reason for that, must be a functional reason. And that, you know, so my speculation would be that we meet a variety of situations, that when I'm being flown in a commercial aircraft, I want someone who's abnormally conscientious, and I do not want a creative bastard up there fiddling with the controls. I want a ridiculous, slightly neurotic, conscientious person. On the other hand, if I want an entertainment that will make me laugh in spite of myself, it's probably the other way around. A conscientious person will be dull as ditch water. In other words, my speculation along those lines would be something about meeting the variety of challenges that humans do, and that's probably why diversity is maintained. Of course, that's just a guess, but I'm illustrating how this kind of reasoning is really quite wide. The other one, what should be labelled E, about social, is really a challenge. The way I've been educated is I always am always thinking about humans as individual agents, and on the whole, psychology tends to do that. But as social psychology begins to acknowledge and sociology takes further, there's a question about whether that's the right unit of analysis. Can you understand human behavior as if they were completely separate from other people? And it's clear there's some things that groups do, some ways we behave in groups that are quite different from how we behave individually. And why that's such a challenge to psychology in one sense is it suggests that all experiments that lock people up in a booth by themselves are kind of doing the wrong thing. I mean, it would be like me saying, I want to do psychology, but you're a bit big, so I'll just cut you down the middle and then study the dead half. I mean, if the natural unit where the important interactions are is a group, studying people alone is just a fundamental blunder. Now, so that's why it's such an important challenge. Doesn't mean we might not, in the end, want some of both, but that's why worrying about this is a fruitful thing to do. So the main three types: behaviour, what the person does as a whole, external observations of the whole person, whereas what might be called introspection, more politely called verbal reports, is what they tell you about what they think, they feel, they are aware of, what they're conscious of. Or what their attitudes are as expressed, usually verbally. And physiological observations would be those measurements. So a good example of physiological measurements and why they're independently illuminating is that if you interviewed me, I'd probably say I was relaxed here. After all, none of you are going to, you know, have published psychology papers. You're not going to stand up and contradict me with more authority than I have. It's actually irrational of me to be afraid of students, and I'm not consciously afraid of students. On the other hand, if you measure my pulse rate, it will be going quite a bit faster than if I sat in my office. So it doesn't mean I'm aware of my own state. Physiology can tell tales on us in ways that can be useful. Now, although I think it's interesting and important to think about what we'd like in a psychology, there's just no guarantee we can necessarily have it. And indeed, to go the other way, a pessimistic view of psychology is that it's a waste of time because it's impossible. And here's a superficially plausible argument in the middle of the screen about why. I mean, how can a human understand a human? A model of the full complexity of me won't fit inside me along with all the other stuff, will it? Be like Doctor Who's TARDIS, bigger on the inside than on the outside. Surely that's not possible, except on TV. Still, in spite of the fact that we've got no right to expect it, I think it's important to recognise that there's a great urge in researchers on the whole, at its biggest and maddest in physics, but also strong in psychology, is that surely we can understand things. It's just now we don't understand them, but tomorrow we will. So, to repeat something stated earlier, theories which fail to relate all three kinds of evidence are probably going to always feel to us, rationally or not, that they lack something. So, if there's a theory that predicts behaviour, but nothing else, isn't that just ethology, the word for animal behaviour? Or if it just predicts how people feel, but not how they behave, surely that's literature, not science. Or if it just predicts the physiological measurements, but not what people feel, nor what they do, that's just medicine, that's not psychology, is it? So, we probably want all of them. So, I think I'll close on this slide, where I'm expressing a critical thinking tip that if you're critiquing a paper in psychology, always a good thing to think about is, has it dealt with all three kinds of data? The answer is usually no. And do you think it's disgraceful for it not to have done, or is it understandable because they've opened up a new area? They acknowledge that it will hopefully in future link to it. Because I think a disreputable paper tries to just think its own data is the only stuff that could be important, and then it doesn't manage to do self-criticism about cross-checking with others, whereas other papers are better at that. So I think I'll pause at that moment, continue tomorrow. There's a discussion question up on the website. And it would be good if you thought about that in the next 23 hours.